Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hey, guys. It is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun, too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino-style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Good evening. He promised to kill me when he got out. I believed him. If I wanted justice, I had to fight both him and the courts, maybe kill him first. If I didn't do something, I was going to die. This is not a manufactured dialogue from a thriller, but the words of attorney Sharon Muse. They came after she survived an attempted kidnapping, rape, and murder at the hands of Hank Morrison, a former client. On April 7, 2006, Muse miraculously escaped from the sociopathic Morrison, only to find that the threat of her life was just beginning. Ineptitude in the justice system threatened to release Morrison and allow him the opportunity to finish the job, which he adamantly pledged to do. Muse would have to fight at every step to ensure her safety. She would act as her own advocate, investigator, legal counsel, and bodyguard in the years following the event. Kidnapped by a client covers the brutal kidnapping, two trials, two appeals, procedural errors galore, one Supreme Court reversal, and even Muse's intricate plan to murder Morrison before he could get to her. Muse would not ultimately execute that plan, and she would emerge victorious in the legal battle thanks to her faith and her own determination and legal acumen. But her safety is not insured. Morrison is up for parole in 2026. Muse regularly monitors his status. Muse recounts her stranger-than-fiction story and kidnapped by a client. She analyzes the failures of the legal system, the mistakes she made, the steps she took to protect herself, and how she has coped with trauma. Listeners will find not only a compelling narrative, but also insight into how to protect oneself and ensure one's own safety and well-being. The book that we're featuring this evening is Kidnapped by a Client, the incredible true story of an attorney's fight for justice, with my special guest Sharon Muse and Rob Johnson. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Sharon Muse and Rob Johnson.
Thank you for having us. Very excited to be here.
Thank you very much for both of you for joining me.
Thank you.
Now, Sharon, can you just give us a brief background before we get into this incredibly personally and intimately involved story of your life and this incredible incident? Tell us just briefly what your life was like before this, your work as an attorney, and where exactly Bourbon County and Scott County, where exactly are we talking about where this occurred?
Bourbon and Scott County are the two of the several counties that surround Fayette County in central Kentucky, which is Lexington. We're more rural, would not be considered a city probably by anybody's standards. Prior to this, I had your basic small town practice, did a lot of a variety of different kinds of cases. Very carefree, very lighthearted, never really concerned with security or safety, never considered a client could possibly be a threat to me. Typically, they like you because you're helping them, you're fighting for them, you're advocating for them. Like I said, I took a variety of cases, and unfortunately, I got involved with this particular man because I felt sorry for him and his wife and did some free legal work, and that's how I came to even know that he existed.
Let's go back to the day in question, the fateful day, 2006, April 7th, and you had got some bad news about your mother. So tell us where you were that day, and when you were talking about the news, you said you had a bad day before we talk about your fateful meeting with your former client.
I'd gone into work that day dressed very casually. I had on jeans and just a cotton pullover shirt with like a stretchy neckline, and you'll hear more about that later. But my plan was just to work on some appellate briefs. I wasn't going to see any clients, and my admin, Judy, I'd instructed her. I said, I can't be bothered by anybody. I have to focus. Like, this is my deadline. So I was working on the computer, was getting close to being done, and my mom stopped by the office and came in to tell me that she had just left her doctor and they had found some strange black spots on her lungs, and they weren't clear what they were. They believed them to be a rare form of cancer and something that we couldn't get treated locally. So that just completely derailed my day. And I stopped doing my legal work and started researching, trying to figure out who would be an expert and who could I take my mom to. And called a friend of mine in Louisville who her mom had a very aggressive form of cancer, and she was very active in her treatment. And so I could just have done a complete shift from practicing law to how can I keep my mom healthy and keep her alive. So my mind was not in a good place.
You had been dating a man named Jeff for about 7 months, and and so tell us what you were doing. You were speaking with him as you left the office. Tell us what the conversation was like, and what happened next as you carried a briefcase and some files to your car.
Well, it was interesting. Jeff always had Fridays off because he was a preacher, and that was, you know, he didn't get Sundays off, and so he was going to be playing golf that day. And we had an understanding that when he played golf, he usually didn't have his phone with him. And if he did, he wouldn't answer. It was just his time away from the world. But we had spoken on the phone briefly. And when this was, again, before smartphones. So I opened up my flip phone and I could see the battery was almost dead. And as I was talking to him, I opened the door to walk out in the hallway and I noticed someone had been waiting outside my door, and when I opened the door, they jumped back so that nobody in the office could see them. And as I rounded the corner, there was a man just walking the hallway, and so I told Jeff, I said, let me call you back. Somebody's waiting for me. And when I hung up, I thought, you know, it's going to be a minute before I can call him back because my battery's dead. So I'm standing in the hallway looking at a man who very clearly was waiting for me, His face looked familiar. I couldn't think of his name, and I couldn't think how I knew him, but I was fairly certain he was a previous client. And he immediately starts talking to me about his wife had just died. He was afraid. His family was scared. The assets were frozen. They needed help. This is a Friday now, right at 5 o'clock. And what could I do to help them? His family wanted me to come talk to me. And I was trying to politely move forward as he was talking to me so I could not find myself stuck in a hallway for 30 minutes trying to have a client consult. So I explained to him, it's Friday at 5 o'clock. The courts are closed. There's literally nothing I can do for you. I'm happy to listen, but I need you to go in and talk to Judy, set up an appointment first thing Monday morning. I'll get you in front of judge and we will get you taken care of. And I'm so sorry for your loss, but right now my hands are tied until Monday morning. Well, this didn't seem to settle him down at all. He seemed very anxious and fidgety, and he was, you know, had a lot of energy. And as I moved, he moved, and I would take a step forward and he would not move. So I'd have to take a step back to create space. If I went around the side, it was almost like we were dancing. Every time I moved, he moved. Every time I asked a question, he responded, and he responded with, "My family thinks we need you. We're scared. We need your help." And at some point in this exchange in the hallway, he pulls out a giant wad of cash, not like I'd ever seen anybody carry around before, but it was about the size of my fist. It was wrapped with a rubber band, and it had like some white powdery substance in the middle. I saw it just for a flash, and he tried to put it in my bag, in my briefcase. And I took my hand and waved him off and said, "No, don't do that. This isn't how this works. I don't just take wads of cash. You'll talk to Judy, you'll sign a contract, you'll pay me hourly." I said, "This is not how things work." And he kept trying to get that cash in my pocket or in my bag. And then he stopped for a minute, put it back in his pocket, and continued to say, "My wife just died. I'm scared. I don't know what to do." So in order to get past him, to get to my car where I thought I could leave, I said, "Okay, well, I'm leaving. Walk with me to my car. I'll ask you a couple questions and then come back and make an appointment with Judy." And he said, "Okay." And I thought, okay, I got out of this awkward situation. Good idea. So we're walking to the car and I'm asking him, you know, "Did your wife have a will? Was it notarized? Were there witnesses? Were their names notarized?" Just asking basic questions to determine if, according to Kentucky law, that this would be a valid will.
Right.
And he answered them all. He was very articulate and clear. And we approached the car and I said, "Okay, it sounds like a valid will. We shouldn't have a hard time getting it through probate. Thank you for stopping by. Sorry about your loss. I'll see you Monday morning." I turned my back to him, put everything in my car, unlocked my car, loaded all my files in the back. And as I opened my car door to get in, I look up and he's on the other side of my car with the car door open. And he's physically standing between the car door and the well of my car. And I froze. I didn't know what he was doing or how I was supposed to respond.
Right.
So at that moment, I said, you know, what's going on? How can I help you? What do you need?" And he was like, "Well, can you give me a ride to my grandma's house?" And we had this fairly lengthy exchange. I said, "Well, how did you get here?" "Well, I walked." "Well, can't you walk back?" "Well, it's only 3 blocks." And I'm like, "Well, then that's a short walk." So I went back and forth with him repeatedly without ever just saying, "No, get away from my car. I'm not comfortable." Like, in my mind, I kept thinking, this man's wife just died. He's a client of yours. He trusts you. He needs and wants your help. Why would you say no to him? Like, I almost guilted myself or shamed myself into it. And I continued, though. I just didn't feel comfortable. And I was like, you know, "No, if you walk here, you can walk back." And probably after our fifth or sixth exchange of this, thunder cracks in the sky, and the spring weather in Kentucky is very volatile. It'll be beautiful and sunny one minute and pouring down rain the next. And that was just the final straw for me. I thought, you cannot make him walk home in the rain after his wife is just dead and he just needs some help. But, you know, I was concerned by his behavior. It seemed very, he seemed desperate to be around me. And I thought, well, that's just because he sees me as the person who can help them get through this. Every time my mind tried to tell me, you need to get away from him, I had some excuse, some way to justify that what he was doing was okay and that probably wasn't a big deal. So, I'm sorry.
You had the tenacity, you had the idea that you should make sure that you have your phone and you dial. Tell us about this. Once he's inside the car, what happens, and increasingly in terms of your fear, and at what point do you get the idea to dial your phone and connect with your boyfriend, Jeff?
So when we were standing outside the car, I felt very uncomfortable, but I couldn't really articulate why, but I just felt uncomfortable. When he sat down in the car and I felt the weight of his body hit the seat and he shut the door, some kind of alarm went off inside of me, and I knew that I wasn't safe. I didn't know to what degree, but something in me was saying, you're not safe. So there was no, I can't articulate specific thoughts. I just instinctively, instead of putting my purse where I usually do, I tucked it by my left leg in the car well, and I very surreptitiously pulled my cell phone out, opened it up, flipped it on, and I tucked it kind of under my left thigh where he couldn't see it. Now, I'll tell you, I didn't think the battery was working, but I couldn't figure a way to get my phone plugged into the car charger where he wouldn't see it. And then I thought, well, Jeff's not going to answer his phone anyway because he's about to head out to the golf course. But I know Jeff is very detail-oriented. He's very smart. And I knew if he heard me in a car with a man's voice when he knew I should be driving home alone, he would pay attention. Not because he's jealous, but because he would know that something out of order. So I tucked it away and I hid it. And as we pulled out of the parking lot, you know, I said, where do you need me to go? And he directed me. So I continued to ask him legal questions. You know, are you the heir? Anybody else in your family? Do you think anybody's going to contest it? Because he said he only lived three blocks away, so I expected this to be a very short ride. So once we passed what anybody could imagine would be three blocks, I said, well, you know, where are we going? Where does she live? What's the street number? And once I said that and we got close to the end of that street, again, everything just amped up another level. I was certain at that point that I was in trouble and I wasn't safe. I knew he wanted to do something to me. I didn't know what, but I knew I wasn't safe. And so I tried to talk to him as much as possible. I was desperately trying to remember his name. I couldn't think of his name, but I did not want him to know that. And each time I would ask, you know, where is it? Or, you know, it's been more than three blocks. Very quickly, it turned into him becoming violent. It escalated to where he would put his hands on the back of my neck and grab it, and shake my neck, and yell at me not to disrespect him. Any type of question, any type of challenge as to where we're going, he perceived as disrespecting him, and I wasn't to do that. And he'd stick his finger in my face, or he would grab my neck, or he would rub his hand down my arm, and he would yell and tell me to keep driving and keep driving. And then he would stop and pause and just look at me. And I glanced over at him, and he was looking at me as if we were on a date. And he said, it sure is nice being in this car with you. And that's the moment that I thought, he's going to rape me. And that's when my mind really started spinning. And I thought, What do I do? How do I stay safe? What can I do? And as the drive continues, keep in mind, this is my hometown. I grew up here. I drove right by the street that my parents lived on at the time, where I grew up. I drove by the street where my elementary school was, but I had no idea where I was. All I could think about were his hands. I was trying to dodge the next blow, or at one point he put his hands between my legs, and I would move them, and I grabbed the steering wheel and tried to keep him from being able to touch my breast. And it just, the further out we drove, the more fearful I became, the more desperate I became, and the angrier and more violent he became. So at some point, he sees my cell phone. And because he'd been in prison up to just less than 2 weeks before, he hadn't seen a cell phone yet. He thought it was a digital recorder. So he starts yelling at me and saying, "Are you recording me? Are you recording me?" And I grabbed the phone and I said, "No, this is my phone." And I put it up to my ear. And Jeff was there. I couldn't believe it, but Jeff was there.
Wow.
And at some point during this drive, his name just came out of nowhere. And so I said, "Do you want me to call you Hank, or do you want me to call you Mr. Morrison?" And I said it that way so that Jeff would know who had me. And during this conversation, I had asked him where had he been and what had been going on, because I didn't remember that he had been a criminal client. I thought I had done an adoption for his family. And so this whole time I'm trying to figure out, how could this guy who I did an adoption for be, what is he angry with me about? And so he said, "I just got out last week." And I was like, "Out of prison?" And he said, "Out of prison." And again, that was for Jeff to hear, so that he would know that a man had me, he would know his name, and he knew that he'd just been out of prison. So he jerks the phone away from me, and he's talking to Jeff. And at this point, this is the only point that I can recall, like, actively praying. And I was just like, "Please, God, don't let Jeff make him mad. Whatever he says he's going to take out on me, just don't let him make him mad." All I was trying to do was to keep him calm, because you're in a car. There's no room to go anywhere. Every time I did anything he didn't like, it was a threat or a strike or his in my face and grabbing me or shaking me or stroking me. And all I wanted to do was keep his hands off me. And it came down just from each breath to the next. You're trying to think, how do I just get to the next breath without him touching me or without him hurting me? And I wasn't breathing well. And so I caught myself catching my breath and then sighing. And then that set him off. And he's yelling at me that that's disrespectful and not to do that. And he's again in my face or grabbing my hair or grabbing my neck. And I remember thinking, I can't even breathe without making this man angry, and just desperately trying to think how to get away from him. And we went through the only large intersection that we went through. Because again, this is a rural area. And as we hit the middle, I was going to slam on the brakes and just jump out of my car. If I got hit, I didn't care. I wanted to be away from him. And I started to hit the brakes, and he grabbed my knee and just squeezed. And I knew I had to think of something else. So I kept driving.
You write about the phone call where Jeff talks to Morrison.
Yes.
What does Morrison say to him before he hangs up?
He says, "Don't worry, I'll take care of her." And when he said that and he hung up, I don't know that I can adequately tell you now or even in the book what that did to me, because I knew probably not going to get out of that car ever. And I frantically redialed, hoping and praying that Jeff, that I had battery and that I didn't lose service, and that Jess could hear. And we continue on. The entire drive is just this, me saying, are we almost there yet? Why are you doing this to me? Eventually I start saying, is that an airport? Is that an elementary school? Because I can't think and I don't understand where I am. So I'm just trying to describe to Jeff what I'm seeing so that hopefully he'll know where I am, or he could figure out, or he could call the police and tell them where I am. And Morrison grabbed the phone a second time and was trying to talk to Jeff. And when I put the phone back up to my ear, Jeff said, do you want me to call the police? And I just said, I don't know, because I thought he was my lifeline. What was he going to say when he called the police? My girlfriend's in a car somewhere, maybe near an elementary school with a guy that's been right out of prison. What could the police do for me?
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't even know what county I was in. So at some point I said, are we in Bourbon County? And Jeff wrote that down. And as we continue to drive around and I'm completely disoriented, we came up to a yellow light, a caution light. And when I stopped there, I just started screaming, get out of the car, get out of the car. I don't care where you live. I don't care where she lives. Get out now. I was like, get out. I was done. And he, it was like a role reversal, became very calm. And he was like, we're almost there. It's right down this road. It's three houses down. I'll get out. Just take me to the house. And so part of me thought, okay, I'm wrong. He really just does want to go to his, referred to as his Meemaw's house. So we're driving down this country road, and I said, okay, I counted as I passed you's house. I said, that's one, that's two, that's three. And I started to pull in the driveway, and I said, this is the third house. You're getting out. And he's like, no, I counted wrong. It's over the hill. I drive over the hill because, again, I don't know how to physically get him out of my car, and I didn't know what I was supposed to do if I physically got out of my car. So I pop over the next hill, and there's a big black barn. It's a, you could tell it's an, I would call it an abandoned farm. It wasn't actively being farmed. The barn, you know, it was hay and kind of mold and really tall grass, and there was a barn near the roadway, and then past the barn was a driveway. And as soon as we passed the barn, he said, here's where she lived. And as I looked up at the house, it was a house that was completely dilapidated. Vines were growing through the windows. The front porch was sunk in. The windows were boarded over. And I remember I said, your Meemaw lives there? There was some part of me just desperate to think I was really taking him his grandmother's house. And he said, no, not there. Drive past it, back behind that barn. There was a second barn even back behind the house. And I told you earlier I knew that he wanted to hurt me when he told Jeff,
sure,
don't worry, I'll take care of her. But when he told me to drive back behind that barn, at that point, there's nothing to lose. He's going to kill me. I know he's going to kill me. And at best, I could hope he killed me on the roadway so somebody finds me. So I just said, I said no. I drove past the driveway. I reversed into it, which is something I've never, ever done. But for whatever reason, I drove past the driveway. I reversed in it. I put my car in drive, and I'm screaming, get out of the car, get out of the car. I just over and over, that's all I'm saying. And he puts his left hand on my hand, shoved the gear shift into park, and the next thing I know is my head is being cracked into a window, smacked into a steering wheel. It's just flashes of light. It's like if you're watching an old projector movie and the film comes off the reel and you just see little bits and pieces, light and dark, right, and images. It's just exactly like that. You know, I see the steering wheel coming at me. I can feel the glass in my head. I can just feel his hands digging into my scalp and thrashing me around. And the next thing I know is that he's my head into the console between the seats. And he's putting his body weight into the side of my head and I'm still with my seatbelt on. The car's running. My right arm is crushed under my body. My left arm is under the seatbelt, and I'm stuck. And I see him in what looks like slow motion, moving his right hand, because he's holding me down with his left hand. He's moving his right hand down the inside of his jean leg. And I start screaming, "Jeff, call the police, call the police. He's got a gun. He's going to kill me." And at that moment, my phone went dead. That was the last thing Jeff heard. And when Morrison pulls up his pant leg, he had a knife strapped around his ankle. I just assumed it was a gun. I just saw a black handle. And he pulls it up, and as he's pulling it over to my throat, he says, "This is for those years in jail." And I can see his biceps, like, flexing. His triceps muscles are, the veins are popping up in his arms, and I can see him pressing that knife into my throat, and I can feel the pressure of it, thinking, "This is it. This is it." And I remember being really specific with these thoughts that I told myself, okay, you're going to gurgle, you're going to taste.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Blood. You're not going to be able to catch your breath, and that's it. And I waited, and I kept breathing, and I waited, and I felt the blood, and I felt the warm blood running down my chest, and I thought, I'm still breathing. But I could see him. He was shoving that knife into my neck, and I kept thinking, how am I still breathing? And he said, "Take your pants off." He was telling me what he was going to do to me. I don't remember his exact words, but I do remember he told me what he was going to do to me, and that he specifically said, "Take your pants off." And I said, "No. If you're going to rape me, you can rape my dead body." I had finally hit the rage phase. Up to this point, I'd been confused. I'd been scared. I'd been trying to preserve my safety with whatever naive measures I took, but at this point I knew it was over, and there was nothing that I was going to do that was going to make it easier for him. And if he wanted to rape me, he could kill me and drag my dead body out and do it, but I was not going to make it easier for him. And when I said no, what's the question?
Sorry. And you were a physically fit person. You said you were the best shape you were in your adult life at this point, and
yes,
pumped with adrenaline. So you guys were both, he was hitting you, punching you, you were wrestling and fighting in this car,
yes,
weren't you?
Once he pinned me down with my head like that, I was trapped. But when I said no, the next thing I know, and the only explanation I have for this is some form of divine intervention, because there is no other, nobody else was present. The next thing that happened was he was back over in his seat, because he had been up out of his seat on top of the console trying to cut my throat. He's back over in his seat. The knife is in his hand. The tip is broken off the knife. There's a huge gouge in my dashboard where apparently the knife had been drugged through the dashboard. And my head is still down. And when I saw that he was back in the seat, I thought, this is it. Now, I didn't think, this is it, you're going to get away, you're going to live. I thought, this is it. You can make sure he doesn't get away with this. You know, you hear people say that when they really think they're going to die, they have these flashbacks. They think about things from their past. For me, all I saw, and this always makes me, this is one of the toughest parts, but I saw my elderly parents grieving because they never knew what happened to their daughter. And I just thought, you cannot let that happen. You cannot let them live like that, thinking somebody has to find my body. Somebody has to find me for my parents. And so the only thing that made sense to me was I had to get the keys out of the ignition, because if he couldn't drive off in my car, somebody would find my car and somebody would find my body. And that was my only goal, was just for somebody to find me. So then we really started fighting, and I have permanent injuries to this day from that fight. And it was violent, and it was, both of us were just kicking and punching and anything we could get a hold of. And I kept my eye on the knife all the time. I wanted to make sure. I was just scared I was going to feel that plunged into my stomach. So I was watching the knife, and I kept trying to use my left hand and jerk the keys out of the ignition. Because my thought was, I'm going to jerk the keys out of the ignition. I'm going to throw him out into the field, and he's not going to be able to drive off. He's going to be stuck walking, and we are in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
So I'm desperately trying to jerk the keys out of the ignition, and I couldn't get my hands on him. So then I started trying to kick open the door, and I couldn't kick open the door. So I was trying with my hands to open the latch. So I'm fighting him with my right hand and using my left hand to try to open the latch. And I couldn't open it. So I'm bouncing. Do I look away from the knife for a second to see where the door handle is? Because I didn't want to take my eyes off that knife. So just for a second, I glanced away to get my hand on the door handle to open the door. And when I did, I saw a red truck driving in the distance. And at that moment, I told myself, you can survive this. Get in front of that red truck. Just get in front of that red truck. I forgot the keys. I'm still fighting with them. But now I'm like, just get out of this car. And so we fight. We're on a farm on a kind of a dirt gravel road. I get my left foot out the door a little bit, start to leverage myself out. He pulls me back in. We fight some more, and I just keep thinking, that truck's going to pass me, that truck's going to pass me. I did it a second time. I got my foot out. He jerks me back in. The third time, I don't know what I did different. I don't know what happened, but I was able to leverage my leg against the base of the door and just pull myself out with my legs. And my one leg was trapped with my purse wrapped around it, and I'm running with my legs tangled and my purses and the contents are flying everywhere. My breasts are exposed where he'd ripped my shirt down, and blood's running down my chest. I had chunks of hair hanging out of my head, and I ran straight into the middle of the road and just stopped and spread out my arms and spread out my legs and was determined that this truck was not going to go around me. And it was difficult to put yourself in front of an oncoming truck on a country road. My body, I could feel my legs wanting to dive over into the ditch. And I just kept saying to myself, you're either going to die out here with him or you're going to get hit by a truck. And I choose the truck. I would much rather get hit by the truck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And understandably, this man driving the truck is just driving down a country road. And here comes a partially exposed woman with blood running down her chest and chunks of hair hanging out of her head, screaming, no idea what he's just stumbled on. He stopped, wasn't too far from me, and I ran to him, and I don't recall doing this. I don't remember grabbing my phone or dialing 911, but I had. It's on the recording, and I'm screaming, tell him where we are, tell him where we are. I don't know where I am. And he, I think, kind of, froze for a minute. But fortunately, there'd been a truck that I didn't see that drove past. They saw everything, and they voluntarily stopped. It was a husband and wife with their children. And they stopped and got out of the truck. And when I turned around and I saw this man and this woman standing in the middle of the road, it was like, I knew I was going to be okay. Like, up to that point, I just kept thinking, if I run, Morrison's going to catch me. He's just going to stab me to death out here. But these people were out of their truck and they were coming toward me. Man, was the kind of man you wanted to stop. He was big and intimidating, and his wife was immediately making a beeline for me. And I gave them the phone, and he gave 911 directions. Because as soon as the phone had disconnected with Jeff in the car, after I screamed and said, "He's got a gun, he's going to kill me,"
right,
Jeff called the police and said, "I don't know what to tell you, but someone's trying to kill my girlfriend in her car somewhere in Bourbon County," and that's all he could tell. So from the point that he had called to the point that I had called, they had detectives out. I think they called Scott County. They were asking for a helicopter, is my understanding. They had dogs out, and everybody was looking for me.
You were on the phone, and pardon me, the detectives were called, the police were called. There was two phone calls from Jeff and from these people that helped you, Vicky and Cordell Gibson,
mm-hmm,
and this,
yes,
other man named David Rowe that we talk, mm-hmm, about a little bit later. So what was his behavior? What was Morrison's behavior once these people arrived, intervened on your behalf? How did he play these three people? How did he act, and what did he say?
So it was so bizarre. I don't know what I would have expected, but he sat in the car for a few minutes. The witnesses all hear me telling 911 the story. I'm yelling at the same time I'm talking to them. I'm yelling to them, "Be careful! He's got a knife. He tried to kill me. He tried to rape me." I was afraid for their safety, and I wanted them to understand that this was a violent guy, and they needed to be careful. And for the first few minutes, he sat in the car. Then he gets out of the car, and he starts talking to them. And he's talking to them, referring to himself as, he says, don't you know who I am? I'm Morrison." He just refers to himself by his last name. "Don't you know Morrison?" And they all three stop and kind of look at each other, and they're like, "No." It took everybody. We were all shocked that he comes out and he's like, "Well, don't you know me?" And he starts telling them that I'm just tripping, that we're out there together, that I'm mad at him. I tried to steal money from him, that I've made all this up, and they can just go on about their way. This is just a little squabble. And I said again, "Be careful, he's got a knife." And he said, "I don't have a knife." And I said, "He tried to rape me." And he said something to the effect of, "I wish that he would rape me. What a treat that would be for me."
Yeah.
And he continues to talk to them. And so I believe it was Codell got out of the back. It was Codell or David got a pipe out of the back of their truck.
Right.
And the two of them formed kind of like a wall between Morrison and myself, because once he got out of the car, he started walking towards them and then kind of around them, like he was trying to get around them to get to me. So he continues to kind of shout stuff, and he's showing, it's apparent he still wants to physically get a hold of me. Vicky Gibson is staying beside me. She's trying to help me stay calm. She's just, and I, you know, here she's talking to her husband, and her husband is like, "Get the lady away, get the lady back, create some space." They're trying to keep him controlled, and they're saying, "You know, you just need to stay here. The police will sort it out." And I know this doesn't make sense probably to your listeners, but this whole time I keep thinking they're going to leave. They're going to leave. This is dangerous. They don't know if he's got a gun, and they're just going to leave,
right,
me here with him. So I begged them, and sobbing, you can hear me talking to the 911 operator and then looking at them and saying, "Please don't leave. Please don't leave. If you leave me, he'll kill me." And I'm, because I'm afraid they're going to leave, I'm wanting to tell them, you know, "The police are almost here. The police are almost here." And I keep saying, "When are they coming? When are they coming?" So we start to hear sirens. You can't see any lights, but it's from a distance. So we're out in the country, and you start to hear the sound of the siren rolling over the hills and come up and meeting us on the road. And when we all hear that sound, we stop and everybody looks, and Morrison gets really nervous. And he starts looking around. He goes back to the car and he pulls out a bag that to that moment I had not seen. But I saw it. All the witnesses saw it. He grabs a bag, throws it over his shoulder. But before he runs off, Codell Gibson says, "Hey, I see the knife. Put the knife down." And Morrison's like, "I don't have a knife. What knife? What are you talking about?" And Gibson is like, "I see the knife." And I remember he said, "I see the doggone knife. Put it down." So Morrison walks over and tries to give it to one of the witnesses, and he puts it on the truck. And I'm yelling, "That's evidence. Don't touch that." And Morrison walks down the road away from the sound of the sirens and hops a fence, and we see him disappear into a tree line.
You saw some things in that bag. You weren't certain, but there was a couple of things you saw for sure, certain. What did you see in that green bag?
Well, again, first my thoughts when he pulled it out, and it startled me, and I was focused on that bag. And it appeared to have a roll of duct tape and a hammer and some rope. And I just thought, that's what he was going to do to me behind that barn. That's it. Unfortunately, that bag was never found. I begged and begged for somebody to look for it. I went out and looked for it the following Monday. But he had run off into the tree line, and law enforcement starts streaming in kind of one at a time. You know, it's a rural area. They don't get a lot of kidnapping calls, active ones. So volunteers are coming in, police, sheriff's deputies. They're trying to gather, get organized. I'm freaking out because I'm all of a sudden thinking about a trial now and evidence and crime scene and photos and what are we gathering and what's going on. And their concern is, you know, finding this guy, obviously.
Right.
And so I called a friend of mine, his name's Steve Shoring. He was actually my trial practice professor, and we got to be good friends, and he's a brilliant criminal defense attorney. And he answers the phone, and I just start screaming, they're ruining the crime scene. Nobody's doing anything. And nobody's like collecting evidence. They're not taking photos. Nobody's talking to me. And so he calms me down and he's like, just talk to them. You're going to be okay. He's trying to, you know, calm me down. So, one of the officers came up to me and asked me what happened. And I just briefly explained to him, and he said, "Oh my God, you were abducted." And I remember I turned around and looked kind of almost behind me, and I was like, "What?" And he said, you were kidnapped. And I just thought, who would kidnap me? Like, I still, even though I just had lived it, I was still not able to call it what it was or see what it was. I just found myself either completely terrified or in trial practice mode. I was either terrified and sobbing or looking at the scene trying to see what we needed for a trial, and there just didn't seem to be anything in between. So they disperse. They're out looking for him. An ambulance shows up and a state trooper shows up. And for a while I was there by myself, and I thought, okay, he's going to circle back around and kill me while I'm standing here alone while everybody else is out looking for him. But thankfully EMS arrived very quickly. The state trooper showed up, and he asked me a couple of questions, and EMS kept wanting to check me out. He was bleeding, and I didn't want him to touch me. I didn't want to be touched. And they kept trying to coax me into the ambulance. They said, "Please let us check you out. We just need to make sure that you're okay." But I couldn't. I was more interested in what's going on with the search. Are they going to find him? Where is he? Is he close to me? Because all I knew is he disappeared into some trees. I didn't know where he was. So I'm watching the Bourbon County Sheriff's deputies, and they did an excellent job. They very quickly, I could see their cars all kind of came into a circle. So I thought, okay, he must be they think he's in that circle. And they found him. And I heard them radio the trooper, and they said, we found him. He's not, you know, he's kind of hidden himself and he won't come out. So the trooper took off into the field, and I was left there with EMS. And I thought, okay, they have their eyes on him. You know, I can let them check me out now. So they start checking me out, and they put me in the ambulance, trying to make sure that I'm not, you know, too severely injured. And the next thing I know is they're saying, we need to get out of the ambulance. And I thought, you just spent 20 minutes trying to get me in here. Why do you want me out now? And they said, well, the trooper wants you to identify the guy they found. And I said, okay. So I get out the back of the ambulance, and the trooper had his window down. Obviously the back window was up, and he said, can you identify him? Is this the man? So I walked car, and I just glanced because I did not want to look at him. And I just said, yeah, that's him. And as I turned to walk away, I could see out of the corner of my eye, he starts wagging his head no, and he's screaming, why are you doing this to me? Why are you making this up? Why are you doing this to me? And I just snapped. And I ran towards that car and was beating on the window. I called him and said things that I shouldn't say on your podcast, things I've never said before. I might have made some words up, but it was foul and it was nasty, and I wanted him to understand. I just kept saying to him, you picked the wrong woman. You picked the wrong woman. You're going to die in prison, or I will kill you when you get out. And I was like, you don't have to come looking for me. I'm waiting for you. And just kept trying to get a hold of him. I just wanted to put my hands on him, because for the first time in this whole incident, I wanted to tear him apart piece by piece. And if I had gotten my hands on him, I probably would have. And part of me just wishes I could have for just a few minutes, because I just wanted him to know that he needed to be afraid of me at that moment.
Now let's talk about what happens. We need to sort of move along a little bit towards, and not cover every ridiculous thing that his defense attorney and he contends. Needless to say, what this book really entails a lot of is your fight to be able to gather evidence to assist the police.
Yeah.
You're an attorney,
mm-hmm.
so obviously you know what credible, valuable evidence and what kind of evidence is necessary for the type of conviction that you wanted. So when he talked about you guys doing drugs together, ridiculous notion that you were having late night sex parties where you were performing sexual acts. So some ridiculous, we won't go into it because it's all ridiculous nonsense, but without any evidence backing it up whatsoever. But tell us about what kind of charges with this Gordy Shaw, what kind of charges were available for Morrison to be charged with, and your dissatisfaction with those charges and why?
Well, they charged him with resisting arrest, which is a misdemeanor, and it had nothing to do with me. It was that infuriated me, which, I mean, it's fine to charge him with that, but they charged him with a misdemeanor resisting arrest. They charged him with sexual assault, a lower level sex abuse type charge, when I was looking for attempted rape, since he had a knife and he pushed it into my throat. And let me be clear, the only reason he didn't slice my throat open was because I had on a really chunky necklace with these semi-precious stones, and the knife actually... So my neck had abrasions and bruises, but there was a divot in the stone where he was pressing and pressing, and he had dug so hard he dug a divot out of that stone. That was one of the pieces of evidence I had to beg somebody to collect. But I expected him to be charged, rightfully so, with attempted rape. I wanted them to consider attempted murder. I wanted them, but they got kidnapping, which on its own, kidnapping in Kentucky is only And I say only because when you believe somebody's going to kill you when they get out of prison, 10 to 20 years doesn't feel that long. So it's kidnapping by itself is only a 10 to 20 year penalty. And he's eligible to be released after only serving 20% of that. So the prosecutors never explained any of that to me. I did my own research. So they charged him with one significant charge, which was the kidnapping, the sexual charge, which was, I thought, very weak, and then a misdemeanor. And with certain crimes, if you charge them, there can be no eligibility to be released until you serve at least 85% of the time, which, right, again, some of these other charges would have carried that, but what they charged him with didn't. So that night at the hospital, when the trooper told me what they charged him with, I said, go get your blue book. I'll walk through the elements. I will show you that these facts meet more significant charges. And he wouldn't. And he happened to tell me, and was being questioned at the police department, he mentioned what you said, you know, we were doing drugs together. And I was like, great. Like, that's great. So I got out of the hospital bed and went and demanded a full drug screen, hair, blood, urine, whatever they could do to go back as far as they can go back, because I have never done drugs. And to me, that was, I was thrilled that he said that because it was easy to disprove. So from that point forward, I started drafting emails. The friend that I mentioned earlier, Steve Shoring, that's the defense attorney, he sent letters to the office. We're saying, you know, we think it could be more significant charges. Here's the evidence. Please collect this. I made car payments and insured my car for a year, even though I had it parked on my family farm, because the car was the crime scene. Nobody looked at it. Nobody took photos. I took photos. I'm the one who requested photos of my injuries be taken. And all the photos shown at trial were photos that I took. Nobody else took them. So I spent the first several months, 3 months after this happened, I didn't sleep. Every night I would push my dresser in front of my door in my house. I had all new windows put in, new locks, exterior lights, bought a new gun, did some training, didn't go anywhere without a gun, only went to my house and to work. I stayed home for 5 days after it happened. Then I went back to work, but I never went anywhere without my gun, and I almost never slept. And I was so exhausted and so tired of asking somebody to pay attention to this case after multiple calls, emails that I still have saying, call here, this person knows this, here's a piece of evidence, I still have my shirt, I still have my necklace, please come look at my car, you'll see how violent it was, you can see the knife damage, the inside of my car. You know, anything, and nothing was happening. And, you know, when you go to bed every night and you wake up every morning more tired than you were when you went to bed, and you're literally just waiting for someone to kill you, because the last thing he said to me when I was pulling out of the car, when I was running out towards that truck, was, it doesn't matter if you get away, I am going to kill you. And I believe him now. I believed him then. He had just tried to kill me. Of course, I believe he's going to come back. So I'm doing everything I can. You know, without interfering in the case, I'm trying to build it and think about it. I'm talking to my friends that are lawyers, and I was like, what, you know, what's going on? Why can't I get anybody to pay attention to this? So at some point I was sitting in my office looking out the window, and I noticed they were bringing some inmates in from another county to come to court in Scott County. And it just clicked. And I thought, okay, here's my answer. My office, I went over to the courthouse. I was trying to figure out how the back stairs work, where they bring the inmates. On my way back to the office, I ran into one of the sheriff's deputies and asked him, when you transport prisoners, you know, what steps do you bring them up? Because Morrison was being held in Bourbon County because that's where we were found. And I had filed charges against him in Scott County on my own. The Monday after I was kidnapped, I went and filed additional charges in Scott County so that if he got out of jail in Bourbon, he would immediately have to go to Scott. That was my hope. I was just trying to buy myself some time so that if he was able to make bail, that at least I would have warning and he would be then in the Scott County jail and I could do whatever I had to do to keep myself safe. So after months of this, I thought the only thing I can do to stop living with this constant fear is to just take care of things myself.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
So, I came up with a plan.
Now, luckily, you talked yourself out, or were talked out of this plan, and you fought for justice the conventional way, the way you knew. But this is a great demonstration of the incredible fear, the real tangible fear that this man would kill you. There's a bail hearing. You realize that he was living with his grandmother three blocks away. His grandmother was calling you to basically say, listen, you got my son all wrong or my grandson all wrong. You should just back off these charges. So intimidation and fear were just your constant companions. Now, with this grand jury, you thought that you had given Gordie Shaw, you tried to give Gordie Shaw a bunch of evidence, but it didn't seem like anybody was cooperative whatsoever. You realized and you were told and people have said that a grand jury, it's easy to indict. In fact, the grand jury could indict a ham sandwich. Yes. What happens with the grand jury, despite when you learn that Cordell and Vicki Gibson gave really strong statements that you thought supported even the attempted murder charge that wasn't laid? But what happens with this grand jury and the indictment?
Well, I'm not allowed to know what happens in grand jury. It's all secret, other than I'm allowed to know what charges come out of it.
Right.
I had asked that they present attempted rape and attempted murder and some other charges. I was told by the prosecutor that they had presented it and the grand jury wouldn't indict. So I asked to hear the tapes because I didn't believe them. Because just the statements from the Gibsons alone, without my statements being considered, their statements would have been enough for that. And once I demanded to hear the tapes, I was told there was a mistake. They actually never had presented them. I continued to politely ask, and then not so politely asked, and they were never presented to grand jury. As far as I know, they only presented the kidnapping and the demeanor charge and the sex abuse charge. Now, what did scare me is that the one thing that the trooper did through all of this that I'm really grateful for, he didn't have to do, and I appreciate it. He called me after he presented to grand jury, and I said, well, what did they say about the rape or the murder? And he said, well, I didn't talk about that. And I'm like, well, if you're the only witness. He said, well, they didn't ask me questions about that. And so I knew that it hadn't been presented. But he said there was only one question that was asked, and it was a woman, and she asked, why did she let him in her car? And that question, I think, is what drove me to consider taking justice into my own hands, because I just kept thinking they'll never convict him on kidnapping. They're going to blame me. They're going to think, and so I just thought that we wouldn't prevail with that. So This all happened, like I said, within the first couple months after the kidnapping, and it was actually at a church retreat where I finally realized, okay, you know, if I actually move forward with this, one, I'm not trusting God to keep me safe, and two, I'm no better than Morrison, and that I just have to, regardless of what happens, I cannot walk with this kind of hatred or anger for somebody, because I'll tell you that the hatred and the resentment that I had developed for him was changing who I was as a person, and it was making me bitter. And this may sound strange, but I forgave him, and doing so was the best gift I could give myself. That just took so much off of me. Now, when I say I forgave him, I still think he needs to die in prison. Forgiveness doesn't mean somehow he's off the hook, or that we're buddies, or I'm going to make him brownies and go have a Bible study with him at the prison. It just means that, to me, I no longer am going to hunt him down and kill him. I don't have that drive to do that. I have accepted what he chose to do, and I think he needs to be punished to the full extent of the law. But oftentimes when I talk to victims, the most meaningful thing you can ever do is forgive yourself and forgive the person that did it, because you do spend a lot of time beating yourself up. And why didn't I do this differently? And why didn't I do that?
Let's get to the trial, because we have a lot of story to go to explain for the audience to hear. We have on the line the former judge, Rob Johnson, a judge presiding at this trial. Unfortunately, the line seems to be not very good, and I want to make sure that people get the story. So, Sharon, I'm going to get you to continue with this trial, telling me what happens at this trial and about the plea agreement and some of the pressure that you put on. And it's interesting for the audience that not every jurisdiction in the world has this, that our district attorney, a prosecutor, a commonwealth attorney, would call you and ask you if a deal that were presented were sufficient. So tell us about this trial and these are plea agreements that they presented to you and your response.
Well, the Friday before the trial was supposed to start on the following Wednesday, I got a call to come in and meet with the prosecutor's office. And I was so excited. I thought, okay, they're going to prep me. We're going to talk about questions. We're finally going to do this. And they brought me in and they told me about a letter that that Morrison had written in jail, and he was writing it to his attorney. Basically, it's his version of the story. And he had one of his cellmates sign it as a witness. And that cellmate told the jailer, so the jailer faxed a copy to the prosecutor's office, because it's not privileged when a third party signs it. So I got to read it. And he basically admitted to everything. And then the prosecutor asked me, keep in mind, this is a year later, so a year had already passed, if I would accept a 5-year offer on this case, which would mean he literally would be available to be let out of jail the same day, because he would only serve 20% of that 5 years.
Wow.
Which, again, they didn't explain that to me. I had to figure that out on my own. So I had a pretty aggressive, negative response to that. Again, don't know what I should say. But it was a firm no, unequivocal.
Yeah.
And told them not to bring anything back that to me again, that I would accept a life sentence, but nothing less than that. And the only reason a life sentence was available was because this guy had a lengthy felon past. So he's what in Kentucky we call it a persistent felony offender. So
right.
Even though kidnapping only was 10 to 20 years, being a persistent felony offender bumps it up to 20 to life. So 20 then becomes the minimum on just that one charge. So, of course, 5 years was nothing I would even consider. And
right.
I explained to them, he tried to kill me. He's going to kill me. No, I'd rather lose at trial than agree to 5 years. So they gave me a copy of that letter. I asked for it. I spent the weekend at Kinko's, made huge exhibits, stuff passed out to the jury, drove back Monday, had to borrow a friend's Jeep because the exhibits were too big for my car. and dropped them all off at the prosecutor's office. That I wanted to be prepped and didn't hear much other than show up at the courthouse at noon on Wednesday. So I'm driving to the courthouse at noon on Wednesday again, haven't been prepped, don't have a clue what I'm going to be asked, don't know anything about what's about to happen. And I get a call from the trooper, and he said, the prosecutor and the defense have agreed to 20 years, but the judge won't take it unless you agree. And I said, 20 years. And he said, yeah. And I said, again, very aggressive, no. And I hung up on him. And I, of course, and Steve, the same friend that I keep mentioning, he was driving me. And he said, Sharon, he said, they're not prepared. They're not going to pursue the sex charge. It's very likely you won't prevail at trial. He said, I'm not comfortable with it. He said, I think you need to take the 20. He said, yeah, we could not see any work that they had done to be successful at trial. And he said, you need to take it. So I called the trooper back, didn't want to take it, was mad about it, but I said, fine, I'll take it. And again, they had told me not to be at the courthouse till a certain time because they were going to be picking a jury. And when I got there, everything had happened in the court. The judge had dismissed the jury, and I was told that they had recommended 20 years. And considering that I was fearful that we would get a not guilty, you know, I had a lot of mixed emotions. I wasn't sure what to think. Came back, and I don't know if you want to hear Judge Johnson's perspective on it, but
well,
I've got him.
Like I said, his line has been compromised, so I'm going to have to get you to tell his side of this.
Okay, so we show up several months later for the sentencing thing. And the judges, what's interesting, a lot of people don't understand, is judges have no idea what goes on in a case other than what's shown to them in the courtroom. They don't know about the investigation. They don't know my story. They only hear it as it's played out in trial. And since he entered or agreed to 20 years, there was no trial. So judges get what's called a report, a PSI is what it's called. And it's a pre-sentencing investigation, and it gives them more details about the defendant and the crime. And then I wrote what's called a victim's impact statement, and I think I sent in almost 50 different people wrote letters to Judge Johnson because I wanted him to understand the impact that this had on me. So we went to sentencing, and I had Steve on one side of me, literally physically holding me up because my hands were shaking and I was just openly sobbing in court, which of course is humiliating. This is the courtroom I practice in. These are my colleagues, the bailiffs, the clerks. These are people that know me and see me work all the time. And except for Judge Johnson, I had avoided his courtroom as a lawyer because he was the judge in my case, and he had been an outstanding judge, and I didn't want him to have to accuse himself. So I avoided him at all costs, but everybody else in the room I knew quite well. So I'm sobbing and I'm crying and I'm trying to talk, but no sound is coming out. And my friend Amy is on the other side of me, and she's pointing. I have like this bullet list where, you know, she's pointing her fingers like, tell him this, tell, you know, these are my notes. These are things I want to tell the judge. And I couldn't get it out. And I just remember looking at him, and he looked so, I had his attention. He was leaning up over the bench, trying to hear what I was saying. Steve was like, you've got to speak up. The judge can't hear you. So finally I get out, basically, I want you to give him as much as you can give him. 20 years isn't enough. He's going to come back and kill me. He tried to kill me once. Please do whatever you can to keep me safe. I was like, you're the only one who can keep me safe. And the judge commented on the sentencing report, the defense and their arguments, and said something to the effect that he's one of the most dangerous men that he's seen in his courtroom. He's had a long list of victims before me and now me, and that if he's out of prison, he's concerned there'll be other victims to follow, and that this was going to stop, and this was going to stop today, and that he has now been sentenced to life in prison. And I couldn't believe it.
Wow.
It was definitely a life-changing moment for me. I didn't even hear, I don't even know what happened after that. Steve took my friends and I out to lunch after, because I just kept saying, Steve, I don't know, I don't understand what happened. And we sat down at lunch, and, Steve explained, even though it's a life sentence, he's available for parole in 20 years, because in Kentucky, life doesn't mean life, it means 20 years. But at least, you know, if he had been given a 20-year sentence, it would only mean 4 years. So at least Judge Johnson gave me a guaranteed 20 years. And if I show up every time he's up for parole and talk, then I have the option of fighting to keep him in longer. So we left that day. I thought, finally I get my life back. Finally, I don't have to take a gun with me into the grocery store or to the church. I can actually drive with my windows down or sit on my back porch, which I'd done none of those things for a year. And a few weeks later, I get notice that Morrison has filed a motion to withdraw his plea and claims that he had no idea what he was doing on that day. And, you know, to speed things up for the listener, we just went into a litany of all kinds of motions and excuses. And Judge Johnson did exactly what he should have done and held all these hearings, and there was a competency hearing. And again, in September that year, made a ruling, no, you were perfectly competent. You had capable representation. The sentence stands. So they appealed it to the Kentucky Supreme Court, who essentially came back saying, you know, I think they thought it was too much time for a kidnapping, because kidnapping in Kentucky is 10 to 20. So they came back and said he either gets a new trial or 20 years. And Judge Johnson said this crime was too violent, and with his history, 20 years is not enough. We're going to have a trial. And so the only reason I ever got in front of a jury was because Judge Johnson made the prosecutors go there. They were not going to do it. So then we start what I call the second trial. And there's motions and motions, and the defense tries to get the judge removed. The defense tries to change it to a different venue. They try all types of different things. And we head into the trial, which I would say to you, there was a strong probability that there would have been a not guilty verdict if it weren't for the outstanding witnesses that I had. The defense did a really good job picking apart my story. For example, when I was on the stand, I walked through and I told my story on cross-examination. Up to that point, no one had asked me any questions about the sex abuse charges. And again, right. I knew the prosecutor wasn't pursuing it. And Steve had told me, he said, look, when you're on the stand, if they don't ask you, don't mention it. You'll confuse the jury. If they're not going to pursue it, you cannot make them. Well, I'm just stubborn, I guess, because on cross, I decide I'm going to talk about it. And I did. And I was desperately wanting that charge because I wanted as much time as possible. I just kept thinking, the minute this guy gets out of prison, he is going to come back for me. I need as much time as I can get. So on cross, they're saying to me things like, you know, you were so traumatized that how can we really trust your opinion? You're not testifying about what really happened. You're testifying about what you were afraid might have happened. And they went on to say, how did you get to the hospital that day? And I said, well, I was taken by ambulance. And the defense attorney said, well, why would the state trooper testify that you drove your own car? And I said, I have no way of knowing why he would say that. He was there and actually got me out of the ambulance to identify Morrison, so I don't know why he would say that. And I looked at, you know, the prosecutor was questioning me. His name was Keith. And I looked at him and I said, I am certain that it's in my medical records that I was taken by ambulance. So this is my clue. Like, show me the medical record so that we can take care of this problem. Because if I was on the jury, I would think this poor woman, she was so scared, she doesn't even remember that she drove her own car to the hospital. Like, it would completely discredit me. Well, nobody cleaned it up. When they got up to do redirect, didn't ask me a thing about it. So when I got off the stand, I thought, I just lost the case. They're going to think that I was so, they're not going to think I'm a liar. They're going to think that I was scared and emotional and traumatized. And because of that, I don't remember things accurately. And they're certainly not going to put somebody in prison for life based on that. But it's right, it's at the very bottom, page one of the medical record, brought in by ambulance. I don't know how much easier I could have made it for them to clean that up, but it didn't happen. But thankfully, Jeff Ballard, who was on the phone with me, he was the first witness. And I don't know if your listeners are aware of this, but in Kentucky, at least, when you're a victim of a crime, you don't get to hear anything that happens in the trial. You go in during your testimony, right, and you leave, and you don't know anything else. So I had the entire trial transcribed, which those are the transcripts I use in the book. Right. And when I read Jeff's testimony, it was amazing. The defense kept coming at him, trying to peck away at him. And they said, well, if she was so scared, why didn't she ask you to call the police? And Jeff responded with, well, what was I going to say? What I did say, which was, she's somewhere in Bourbon County and someone's trying to kill her. So he did an outstanding job. Codell and Vicki Gibson, they were outstanding witnesses. In fact, when Codell was on the stand, he's telling the jury how violent it was that they saw us fighting in the car because I was still trapped in the car when they drove by. And he shows the jury how every time I tried to get out, Morrison would yank me back in, and he did it with such enthusiasm that he ripped the shirt he was wearing, and you could hear it rip. And he stopped and he said, just like that. And so it was these great witnesses that led to a jury. And again, from the stand, I looked at the jury and told them, I said, you're sentencing both of us today. You're either going to sentence him to life or me, because the minute he gets out of jail, my life is over. So when you go back to deliberate, you have to decide who you're going to give life to. And they did not convict him of the sex abuse charge because they had no reason to. They were given no evidence. It wasn't mentioned in opening. It wasn't mentioned in the prosecution's closing. But they did convict on the kidnapping. And because of his prior history, they were able to give him life, and they did. And, well, they recommend it. It's just a recommendation. The judge always has final sentencing. So he showed up again in front of Judge Johnson for sentencing.
And
did you have a question?
The result?
Well, I knew that the jury had recommended life, and you would think I would walk in the room fairly confident because he'd given him life before and the jury recommended life. But this is just, you know, when it's your life, there's no, I was terrified. Once again, I stood in front of him,
right,
and I shook and I cried. And when we were, before the judge walked in the room, they had us all walk up right to the bench, and there were a couple of bailiffs. The prosecutor that had been the lead in the case wasn't there. Gordy was there, not Keith. And everybody was kind of mingling and chit-chatting. And Morrison leans over and starts getting aggressive with me. So I just yelled at the top of my voice, are you all going to let him do this to me? Are you going to let him threaten me? Are you going to let him talk to me like this? And honestly, I did it loud enough because I was hoping the judge would hear. I wanted the judge to know that even at this moment, he is still trying to intimidate me and threaten me.
Yeah.
So when the judge came in the room, you know, Morrison gave his plea, told the judge how he'd found Jesus and was living for everybody else now. And I gave him my plea and again told him that the only reason that I was there to speak on my own behalf was because the defendant had failed at his plan. His plan was to kill me, and that should have been my mother standing there begging for a sentence, because I would be dead if the defendant had gotten what he wanted, and it was only because he failed that I was there. And the judge listened and again was very detailed in his sentence. And I asked him, the prosecutor didn't, but I asked him if he could do anything to discourage the parole board from giving him any type of release, that would obviously mean the world to me. And I thanked him for letting me speak and told him that it's up to him, that he was going to give me my life back, or there would be a date and time certain that things would be over for me. And at this point he'd heard the trial, so he knew the evidence and he knew the witness's testimony. And even the expert that the defense brought in spoke that the defendant was manipulative and calculating. And so he again sentenced him to life and said that he found him to be a threat to society and there weren't going to be any more victims after me. And he sentenced him to life. And again, I melted down and wept. And 2 years later, his appeal was exhausted with the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, thankfully, this time upheld it. And so I have till March of 2026 to not have to look over my shoulder.
What happened January 30th, 2008? Bourbon County, you tell us what your aspirations were. What happened in that regard?
January 30th of 2008?
18, pardon me.
18. Oh, okay. That's okay. Well, I drove to Frankfurt and filed papers to run for the Commonwealth Attorney's Office. The office that prosecuted my case is, we're not called district attorneys in Kentucky. It's the Commonwealth Attorney.
Right.
And I ran against the men that prosecuted my case. So I filed to run against them. I called them and said, I appreciate the things that you did do, but as you know, I was horrified by the long list of things that weren't done. And I want to do better. I don't want anybody to have to feel the fear and desperation that I felt for so long. And before I ran, I went to the courthouse and read my file. And like early on in the case, Judge Johnson upped Morrison's bond to $1 million full cash. Nobody ever told me. I missed years of sleep thinking he could get out any day. And if I had known that, I would have never planned to kill him. I wouldn't think I had to. But just little things like that just weren't attended to. So I filed to run. I campaigned. The campaign was rough because the very people that, you know, were supposed to have prosecuted my case attacked me. They said I was lying about the case. So I, you know, posted the Supreme Court ruling and said, read it for yourself, you know, read it for yourself. And I won by a significant margin. And since that time, I've been running the office, and we do things very differently. I'm very proud of what we do. It's very different for crime victims around here now. And what's very interesting, November 8th is the day. I won my election in November 2018. A few days after, November 8th, I called Judge Johnson. Now, keep in mind, have been in awe of this man because he was an excellent judge, and I avoided him, had spent 10 minutes around him all these years. But he had been our circuit judge for 12 years, and then he moved up to the Court of Appeals for 2 years, and his election day was the same as mine, but he lost his Court of Appeals campaign. It was just a completely different ball game. It was 11 counties as opposed to three, and I hated to see him not on the bench anymore because he is truly one of the best judges we've ever had around here. So I called, there's a prosecutor named Ray Larson. He's retired now, but he prosecuted for, I think, more than 40 years. He created victims advocacy here in Kentucky. He was given an award by the White House. He and Gail Witt are just champions for victims. So he had been a mentor to me through the campaign. So I called him November 8th, and I said, what do you think if I call Judge Johnson and ask him to come work with me? And he said, well, if you can get him, that would be amazing. Like, because obviously he's going to bring gravitas to the office, a wealth of knowledge and history. And I thought, I don't have anything to pay him. He's being courted by all these big firms because they all want this Court of Appeals judge on their letterhead. So I was very nervous when I called him. And I was talking fast and giving him all these reasons why it would be so great for community service. And no, he's not going to get paid anything, but wouldn't that feel great to work for the community? Yeah. And he said he'd consider it. And a few days later, he called me back and said he'd take the job. And we started working together in December of 18. And the best part of the story is November 8th of 2019, exactly a year later, he proposed and we are now engaged. So I get to marry my hero.
That's incredible. Incredible story.
A lot, Sharon, of good has come from it.
Absolutely. Before I let you go, I wanted to mention the website, www.ownyourmoment.org, that may help others, that you have, is important to include in your book. And also Real True Stories. There's a film and TV development company that has a little film clip online. Tell us a little bit about if you have a website for this book or how people might be able to contact you, your Facebook page, do any of that. Tell us how they might contact you or find more about this book.
There is it's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and there's a video that a professional film company made for me, and there's Sharon Muse author page on Facebook, and it's got the video. It's a 50-second video. It's my actual 911 call. It's very compelling. But they can find out more about me on Facebook. And Own Your Moment is really for people, crime victims. And one of the best things I ever did was read Gavin DeBecker's book, The Gift of Fear. Everybody should read that book. I have given out over 100 copies. And I mention his book on my website. And on the site, I go back through and I walk through. If you read it, I walk you through the story of the second I walked out my office door until I was at the hospital, all the clues that Morrison gave me that he was going to hurt me that I didn't see. And after I read Gavin DeBecker's book, The Gift of Fear, he teaches you, here are these indications that you're not safe. Trust your gut. Listen to them. And here are things you can identify. So I break that down in my story with the hope that people will read that and if they're in a situation like mine, they don't end up out on an abandoned farm with a knife in their throat, but they see it faster and they're able to stay safer earlier.
Absolutely.
So
go ahead.
I just would strongly recommend that. He does an outstanding job teaching you what to look for. And then I try to break it down in a more simplified version using my story as an example.
Right. And it is an incredible story indeed. Thank you very much, Sharon. Kidnapped by a Client, the incredible true story of an attorney's fight for justice. Sharon Muse. And I want to thank very much former judge Rob Johnson. We had technical problems with his phone line, but thank you very much for Rob Johnson being available for this interview. Thank you very much, Sharon Muse, for
thank you.
Kidnapped by a Client. You have a great night. Good night.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Bye-bye.